digging little 1 metre square holes scattered around targeted locations around the site to have a look at through the depth of the soil as to what might be there and the sort of age it might be. And I'm not going to take any of your thunder. Some of the finds were interesting, some were pointless. But we will hear some more. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you, Andrew. So can everyone hear me all right? Okay. As I say, the red light's not flashing. Does that matter? Okay, that's fine. Okay. Thank you very much, Andrew. You've given a very good context to this and sort of stolen my thunder that this project is sort of a follow-on from the Tillingbourne Tales project, because of all the seven villages along the Tillingbourne, all the sort of industrial history that I had to look at, Albury was my favourite and was the one that I said I do want to come back here and do some, you know, proper archaeology, particularly in the park. So come 2023, working with Michael and the estate and gotten their permission to undertake a community archaeology project in Albury Park, and we're now in sort of our third season of it. So what I'm going to do tonight is sort of give an overview of the project, what we've tried to achieve, what our sort of sources are, how we come about. The study itself, where we get our information from, and a bit of an overview of what we've found to date, and maybe a bit of where we're going from here. So this is a project that specifically is trying to look for what we'll call our deserted medieval settlement, because nowadays we prefer that to deserted medieval village, which was sort of the term that was a bit more popular probably in the 1960s, but along the Tillingbourne that we know is centered here in Albury Park, which was the original village of Albury. I'm not going to give a huge amount of historical context, because I know this group has heard it probably several times previously, talks from Trevor in particular, but I will give a little bit of overview in a minute. What this project actually sort of entailed was a bit of a reassessment or a reanalysis of the historic landscape of the park, some geophysical survey, and some very large-scale test pitting across the area. And whereas we started out in our first season simply focusing on this area, so again, just for those of you who aren't as familiar, going down here, New Road, driving into the park here, and then of course we've got the church there, the manor house, so this area of sort of brew house meadow, and just in front of the church is where we focused in 2023. Then in 2024, we moved on to the area of the paddock. So again, north of the Tillingbourne, a sort of sheep pasture, I suppose. I think it's gravel pit meadow on the Tithe maps to the south of the road. And then in 2025, lower home meadow and pond meadow here. So just sort of east of the park. And I'm gonna talk about all of that in a minute. So brief little history is that we know from the Domesday listing in 1086 that at Albury we have, I think it's 11 villagers, a mill and a church being sited. We can assume the church is the same as we have today, and the mill is pretty much, again, where we know the mill was in existence and is sort of the mill house, today, and only sort of, ended up being sort of moved, going to get this wrong off the top of my head now, around 1800 when it was closed, when it was under Charles Ball, and then of course moved the paper mill further west to the Chilworth ponds. So in terms of the medieval settlement of Albury, the original Albury, we unfortunately don't know very much other than the church itself is medieval, and we have reference to 13th century pottery being found around Home Farm sometime in sort of the last 20 years. There's not really been any medieval evidence, any medieval finds in the park itself. Of the original village, the oldest surviving house is Grange Cottage, so the former pub, the Little George Inn, which has had its roof dendrodated to the 16th century, to 1544. And then we know that the sort of pleasure grounds, the terrace gardens, are sort of 16th, 17th century. The house itself has 16th century origins, and it's always been assumed that it is the place where the medieval manor house would have been. But again, that's a theory. We don't know that necessarily. As we're going to see in a couple slides, the main village itself, what we know of is sort of the 18th century map where the cottages were. And by the time we get to sort of 1780, the 1780s under Captain Finch, he ended up having, we were starting the demolition of the village. So we're getting the east-west road to Shear, which sort of runs just behind the manor house there, being closed, getting a bit of the actual village green and annexed away, and the churchyard annexed away for his own property. By the time you get to Charles Wall around 1810, then the villagers are sort of being kicked out and displaced to Weston. We're getting the old road, which again we'll talk about here in a lot of more detail, Dogkennel Lane being shut. And by, I think it's about 1840, 1844, the new road comes in under Henry Drummond. So we end up seeing a massive change in the original settlement. Unfortunately, when you're talking about a medieval settlement, it's very difficult when the earliest maps you have don't date any earlier than the 18th century. So the main map we tend to reference is the estate map that dates to the 1780s, that shows us great detail, and we're going to hone in a little bit later, where you can actually see the individual sort of details of some of the cottages, you know, specifically what trees we have in the park. Not quite so much detail in the 1701 map, just so you're not confused, I've had to orient it. It's oriented sort of south at the top, so I've had to flip it just so it makes sense here. But we do get certainly a sense of field patterns coming in, as well as where similar cottages being placed here. So again, just to remember, this is the old road, Dogkennel Lane, whereas new road sort of runs there. So we can see very clearly with the placement of these cottages during that time. And then we have a little bit more detail in some of the early 19th century maps. This Anthony Brown map of 1813 is particularly useful because we have numbers. I sort of hit it there, apologies. But we have a bit of a legend here who tells us who happened to, you know, who that cottage belonged to, at least during that time. I'll have to speak to Trevor about this afterwards. I'm not entirely clear if the Brown map is meant to be a copy of a previous one or not, in which case we might get some possible mistakes in there. A bit less detail in the Malden 1825 map. And then, of course, by the time you get to the Tithe and the first OS map. And here you can certainly see the new road having come in by this time of the Tithe map. So again, the old road where it previously sort of ran. And LIDAR, which is something that if you don't have maps, you can often rely on this to get a better idea of what the landscape really was. So LIDAR, for those of you who don't know, stands for light detection and ranging. And the basic principle of it is that a sensor, normally on an airplane, sometimes in a drone, will fly overhead, have a pulse of light that pings off the ground and goes back up to send a return signal. And in theory, it will either hit its first target point, which is the top of the trees, or it penetrates the trees and you get this nice, what we call sort of topographic model or digital topographic model. And that's sort of what we see here. So you're stripping away the tree canopy and you can really make out very clearly here where some of these old field boundaries are, particularly here north of the river, which we're going to be talking about. Obviously we've got the landscaped garden here just to the north of the house and north of the church. And just to give you a bit of bearing here, this is the drive as you approach the church, whereas here is our old road. So clear in the landscape today. And again, it is one of those classic humps and bumps sort of landscapes, Albury Park, not having been under the plow, you know, over the centuries as so many other landscapes are. You can very clearly see and walk the course of the old road, but it's so clear in the LIDAR itself. And we can even see, as I say, the road as it's crossing the river here, the old road, and then continuing north. So as I say, we will refer back to this map. I do tend to plot a lot of my locations on the LIDAR just because it's so useful to get a sense of bearing and what's around you. As I say, just to show again that course of the old road, that's the Tillingbourne there, that's sort of walking along it here as you're walking towards the park. I think this was our first year when we were test pitting in sort of 30 plus degree weather in July. So we gave the volunteers each their own little gazebo to keep them out of the sun. And then I just throw this one up here because we've got these historic maps, obviously no earlier than 1701. We can actually, all those earthworks that we have, again, here to the north of the river in this area here, you know, we know at what point or what the earliest point they appear on the map. So this one doesn't really show up until the second edition, around 1899. These pink ones are our earliest field boundaries, and they disappear by the time of the 1782 estate map, but they're still here at the 1701. So they're at least 17th century, if not earlier. What is interesting is when you look at this landscape initially and you think, oh, that's with some amazing earthworks and ditches and, you know, field boundaries in there. That doesn't mean that these aren't potentially medieval in origins. We just can't say that they're, you know, anything earlier than post-medieval. And there are a few that we can't tie to any maps that we know of. So again, it might just be that there's a map missing, but we'll go back to this one momentarily. So normally, what you do in a landscape study this wide, and again, those of you who know Albury Park very well know it's a massive area to be covering, the first thing you undertake is geophysical survey. So geophysical survey is underground surveying that we do with equipment. We have various types of equipment that we undertake with this. The main one being magnetometry, because it's very quick and it's very efficient, so you can cover large areas in theory very quickly. This is myself with the magnetometer, and as you can see, what it is it's something that you strap on you, and you walk back and forth in sort of parallel lines, 30-meter grids, and what you're doing is you are measuring any sort of magnetic anomalies, anywhere where you get a ferrous signal, or any kind of slightly different signature that's giving a magnetic reading. And you can make out here, hopefully, the most prominent features are all the various service pipes and drains that crisscross. This is Brewhouse Meadow again in the first year. The park, so we've got sort of the new sewer line that goes in. And we know that in the 1970s, when I think it's the sewer line that goes in, they even speak about demolition of some of the old cottages. So we know quite a lot is being destroyed during that time. What it also tells us is not just where things are, but where we don't want to dig. And obviously you want to avoid things like these services when we put our test pits down. So when you get massive signatures like this, all you can really say is it's kind of masking the archaeology, but we do have these little signs of sort of former paleo channels or streams that are in the blue. And these yellow lines here are showing sort of banks, but not much is popping out from that. In the second year in 2024, we expanded it to cover, again, the area here of the paddock and lower home meadow, down here again at the pasture, where we can see more drains and more services going in. But I'm going to talk about this area in a lot more detail here. This is actual archaeology. You'll have to sort of believe me on that it stands out as being, it's busy, it's got a signature of sort of demolition and dump material, and it's not the very sort of high signature white and black that is a suggestion of either a very large ferrous object in the ground or a service. So, and that is a definite ditch of some, these sort of linears here that are faintly black. So that is an area where we would focus in on and say there's definitely something there of interest. And just to finish, last year we just extended again to go to Upper Home Meadow here. So again, more services, a nice little signature there. And then we went to Pond Meadow here, which is east of the Manor House, where you can actually see again the former roads kind of showing up here. But overall, not a lot of archaeology is being picked up in this area. I should add as well that one thing that you can really pick out with things like the magnetometry is how limited it is going to be wanting to put lots of test pits down, because we can't dig anywhere around there. Obviously, we can't dig where we have a lot of trees. We're getting too close to the tree roots. And unfortunately, despite the letter to the estate manager, we weren't able to dig and get actually inside the house. So it's only what is under the ownership of the Albury estate, due to Michael's kind permission, that we've been able to get that access. So getting east of the house here was actually very lucky, because that's about as close as we can get to the actual original manor house. Sorry, that's just a little bit more detail of that one. So resistivity is the other type of geophysical survey that we do. Resistivity is slower. You probably cover about a quarter or a third of the area in the same amount of time, but it tends to show us more interesting information. It's slower because instead of just walking back and forth, you have to walk along and actually stick the two probes in the ground, normally every half meter. And what it is doing is it is running a very faint electrical current between them, and anything that passes over high resistance, like a building, like a wall, maybe a flint foundation, it shows up as a white. And if it's not, if it's something that's very sort of loose, low resistance, then it's black. So again, Broomeadow, we were sort of able to possibly pick out some former cottage foundations there, little signs of the old road. Again, in 2024, we expanded the area here of our res, but you can see how we have to be a lot more selective in the areas where we're having the res. It's this area here though, so again, just north of the river, that hopefully you can see is really interesting. Why is it really interesting? Because we've got these white lines that are very suggestive of being walls making, you know, rooms and sort of parallel buildings, possibly two buildings that are sort of at right angles to each other in the area which we already said has very busy archaeology and is looking quite interesting. This is exciting. That, you know, less so, but so this is going to be a focus here in a minute. So finding that was quite useful. And then this past spring, we just tried to expand it a little bit. Why this doesn't look quite so nice is because it's pretty much impossible to take a resistivity survey from 1 year and then tie it into the next year's, because you can't even necessarily tie in the same survey if it's a week apart, because it's all dependent on what that moisture level is in the ground at any one time. So best efforts, but anyway, we can see a little bit of continuation here with some of the archaeology. Anyway, so test pitting. Andrew has basically already said what test pitting is. It is very small, so 1 meter squared holes or pits that you end up placing in several different locations, because in theory, we get a very good sample of what large landscapes are like. It's very small scale and it's very non-invasive. So we do this for sort of village studies. We do it in urban archaeology. I previously had done a test pitting project in Farnham. So again, you're going into very nice houses in the middle of a medieval market town, very pristine gardens, and saying, can we please put a little 1 meter pit in your garden? Generally, we restore it as pristine as when we left it, or at least, you know, a couple weeks later, let the mud sort of wash away. They're very easy to do. It is something that we utilize currently occupied rural settlement methodology, or the CORES methodology. And that means that we do this for these large rural areas, where, as I say, we sample. And what we do is we don't dig by layers. And by layers, I mean, you know, topsoil, demolition, maybe a sandy layer under there. We dig metrically, where we dig 10 centimeter spits. So everything that comes out of spit one, we keep separate. All the finds from spit two are separate, and we dig them down to 1.2 meters. It's very good as well for children of all ages, school groups to get involved with, and of course adults. So this is just a bit of showing how we do it. So that's the actual digging. Again, I think she's actually got a tape measure possibly in her hand. So she probably has just actually measured down. That is looking at something like eight spits or 80 centimeters down. Everything in theory that you dig out gets sieved. Again, it's very easy to miss these nice little small tiny bits of medieval pottery. If you've got a feature, you record it. And we always draw the section and then the fun, everyone's favorite bit, which is backfilling. As I say, in theory, that's what it'll look like at the end. What I haven't shown here is the hours and hours that the volunteers then go away and actually record and analyze and assess all the pottery and the finds that come out, but that does happen as well. So in 2023, what we end up having is 18 test pits in total. So the project is just getting going. It's quite small scale. We're more just sampling what's there, what's in sort of our area. As you can see, we spread them out pretty well along Brewhouse Meadow and getting down by the church. I should say, by the way, that at this point we have 73 test pits, and I'm not giving you all 73 test pits as an overview. This is very much a selection of just what is the flavor of the archaeology that we were dealing with over the last sort of 3 years. Test pit one, as you can see, was not very successful, not very successfully placed, and this is a good idea why don't just rely on your geophysics, don't just rely on your historical maps. Check Google Earth as well and see if there's a temporary car park that's been placed where your test pit ends up going. Because this one ended up very quickly realizing, okay, that probably was a bit of a waste of time. Got through the demolition anyway, but we didn't try to dig down any further into medieval levels or in sort of the natural. Now, test pit two, a bit closer to the church, I would say it was very barren, and we did dig to what we thought was natural, although we'll say that last year we changed our mind about that. So again, you can dig a test pit even just a couple meters from each other, and they can be very different. Had a couple test pits here in front of the church, sort of where the cars would sort of park now when visiting, and they came down to these sort of chalk surfaces, rather shallowly placed. Again, interpretation isn't really clear on what necessarily they were. Could they be tied to sort of paths, to the church itself? Very possibly. This one here actually sort of goes down as you get to the stream there. But we did get to sort of a medieval level. So you can see quite shallow, the chalk itself. That's underneath it, getting down to medieval layers. They're medieval because we're only getting medieval pottery out of them. So that's what's happening in that area. And then we get to this area here in Brewhouse Meadow. This, we actually have the cottages, former cottages being plotted. They are listed as being two tenement cottages and a cottage. And it's pretty obvious that we have sort of dug through the demolition of them in particular in this area here. So very thick layers of sort of tile, brick, mortar. But when you get under that, you're getting to this very nice, dark, sort of sandy clay, which again seems to be medieval. Now, the downside of hitting these medieval levels, especially so close to the river, is you can see that you start to hit the water table, and there is more medieval here, but it starts to get to the point where they're just not diggable anymore. So we're not hitting the natural, we're not digging all of the medieval, but we're getting a good idea of just the amount that's coming out there. And then this is probably one of my favorite ones, and I'm quite glad that we actually hit it in the first year. This cottage here, so again, that's the old road. I mean, you can see the cottage here on the estate map, and hopefully you can kind of faintly see some linears here, which seem to be foundations showing up in the geophysics. This is in the Brown map of 1813, listed as being a cottage of someone called T. Egerton, or at least that's our best translation anyway of the transcript. We can tell from its depiction on the map that it seems to be quite a prominent cottage. And having dug a meter down, we are getting to at least a wall, a very insubstantial, sort of half meter wide flint wall, no signs of mortaring. And then a bit of a demolition there next to it. So we're finding the foundations of the cottage, but everything that's above here is again sort of 18th century onwards. So it is probably one of these 16th maybe in origin, 17th century cottages, but being demolished around the early 19th century. And test pit four, very similarly here. So we're coming down to this sort of flagstone surface. This is quite interesting because, again, the difficulty with test pits is you're exposing such a small area that if you actually do find a building of some sort, it makes interpretation very difficult. Wondered if this was possibly a wall sill. Again, very difficult. I think the initial thought maybe it was tied to a fireplace. No sign of burning, but again, very difficult to actually make any kind of a decent interpretation, other than very similarly. Probably an 18th century cottage being demolished in the early 19th century. Now, when we get to the junction of Old Dog Kennel Lane, so again, bearing in mind, it's running up here, then crossing over the river there, and that is a junction there, that's when we started hitting much more interesting material. So this is all hitting medieval pottery. We've got a very nice sort of 14th century jeton coming out there of that test pit, and another one again, just by, so that is just one spit. So again, one little 10 centimeter fixed spit. I think this is probably about 50 centimeters down, and it's entirely full of 13th century pottery. So very large sherds coming out. We're very much in sort of medieval contexts here in this area. And one of our nicest finds, certainly in that first year, is this nice little copper alloy, sort of heraldic mount. Might have been something to go sort of on a harness or a carriage. And the crest itself has been identified as being related to the de Beauchamp, who seemed to have a relationship, a family relationship with Scheer during that time as well. So is it coincidental we're getting these sort of trading jettons, potential harness furniture along the old road? Probably not. It's very clear that we've got something going on here of importance at this road junction. What is interesting, and again, just to give you a bit of a sense for those of you who don't remember back from the map, is the actual original Albury Manor ends here. So this little field is actually Weston Manor. And again, the rest of this is Albury. So there is something very important going on at that junction. But again, these test bits are only just giving us an idea of locations. The next year, in 2024, we put in 30 more test pits. Why we put in 30 more test pits is because the project got a lot more popular and a lot more people wanted to get involved and dig. So we were able to have a lot more going at this time. So you can see here, we supplemented much more by putting in some of these pits in this area of the paddock and trying to, again, supplement and sort of bulk out what we had already found the previous year. Here on the little drive, as you go to the house, to the mansion, we aren't getting down on any sign of medieval. Again, at the absolute oldest level here, it seems to be sort of Tudor in date. Again, by the river, very, very deep and nice, thick, wet medieval archaeology coming in. But unfortunately, as I say, we weren't able to quite finish it. Another test pit over the area of the cottage, which again, we were able to get underneath the demolition, which almost suggests it's all natural. What is very clear about this area of the cottage is there's no medieval, and I'm gonna talk about that in more detail. Geophysics, as I say, is very useful. It tells us where many of the service pipes are, but it doesn't tell us where the plastic gas pipes are, especially when they're at that depth. So we do very, very occasionally. I think out of 73 pits, I think we've only three times hit a service, and that being one of them. So it can be a bit disappointing if that's your pit, but anyway, it's not sort of foolproof. A couple more pits here further south on Dog Kennel Lane. So just to say, those of you who know the park, at this point, you're inside the gate of the sheep pasture. So we're getting much further south along it, and we're still getting some medieval archaeology, sort of 12th, 13th century coming out here at the very bottom, let's say digging those to natural. Another pit here at the junction, which hit a sort of a massive dump of slate, and we're talking three different types of slate. We had some Welsh, some Cornish. What it was there for, it was very sort of unclear, and it's not very sure if it was a former trackway that just ended up being sort of filled, so a ditch that had to just get filled with whatever material was sort of readily available. But clearly this is sort of 19th century levels, of course, because we're not going to get very much slate, certainly not in this quantity, until the railway comes through. Again, this is sort of the slope just above the drive, and we're not really getting medieval, we're getting Tudor levels there. More medieval here, again at the old junction of the road, and sort of that final pit of that season. The difficulty with this site is that, as I say, you can only get so close to the river edge without getting into very, very damp, you know, again, ground. But we aren't hitting very much medieval here. It is unfortunate because we know this is the former crossing of the road, and it would be lovely if we could get some nice deep pits, try to find a bit more evidence. But as I say, you just have to be limited by the landscape restrictions at some time. And then as we cross the river, again, we can see the water table coming in. This brickwork just seems to be a dump, by the way, possibly sort of a flood embankment that might have gone in, again, in the late post-medieval period. So that's cut away, but that's not a wall. That is just literally a dump of brick, just to sort of show and give context. As you get closer to the old road, though, we are hitting a lot of Roman as well as medieval. Some nice pieces coming in, including this sort of late medieval strap end. Bits of Roman and medieval coming out as we start to get, again, sort of closer to this area of interest. Now, I say there's Roman coming out. I should add the Roman is mixed in with medieval. So it's medieval levels that has Roman in it, not a Roman context. But as we'll talk about in a minute, finally getting Roman out of this area is really interesting because we didn't have any of it here south of the river. And we tried to put a couple pits over that area that looked like potential building. You could see on this test pit 42, we actually hit the edge of this surface, seemed to be this sort of sandstone, sort of clunch built surface. This very nice hinged book clasp actually being found just literally underneath the turf itself, and also this medieval buckle that was found sort of this level. So again, medieval, but a little bit of Roman pottery coming out. And then another pit over our area of interest, which as you can see, we're hitting a surface down here. A chalk surface, an area of burning. What you don't see here are some very flat tiles, sort of sandstone tiles, very thin, a bit of Roman building material. So we're getting into sort of our combed box flue tiles, and then a lot of demolition here again of sort of flint, clunch being sort of shoved up upon that. So probably Roman down here and sort of medieval levels above it. So it's getting very interesting anyway in 2024. It's very clear we have something Roman in that area. And then this previous season in June and in September, we put in another further 25 test pits. So this is all of them numbered, by the way. It's getting a bit busy and I'm only just going to show you a couple of them. So as I said, this is the old road as it comes along and it goes south of the house and then carries on towards Shear. We put in a couple test pits here along the old road, mainly to see, do we get more medieval pottery this close to the house? You know, is it along the old road as well, or is the medieval kind of more in this area? Test pit 57, right along the old road there, was actually quite interesting because it was fairly barren. So I'm talking there are only about 5 finds in the entire pit, but that included 4 sherds of very early Saxon pottery. So we're talking sort of, 5th, 6th century versus 9th, 10th, late Saxon, which is very interesting because it's the only early Saxon we had found up until this point. It's also being found in several different layers. So it's not one pot. It's showing we've definitely got a lot of early Saxon happening. The fact that it's all along the old road is quite telling. Very interesting. This test bit here, 51, which is just next to the churchyard. So that's the church. It's just south of the churchyard. What you can see here is, again, a very thick layer of probably Tudor demolition. And then this dark area here is getting into Saxon and sort of Norman levels as well. So that's how deep you have to go to get to the medieval next to the churchyard. What is likely is that this is actually some leveling up in, the 17th century probably. So those of you, again, who know the site know that it kind of dips down as you go sort of outside the church wall. They probably leveled it up, as I say, maybe even sort of as late as sort of the 17th, 18th century. And there we go. Another water pipe that I think Michael and the team had struggled to find, or I think was it Thames Water was looking for it. And again, just realizing how deep it actually is, and we ended up finding it. That kind of explained why it was very mixed sort of material up down to that point. So that's there again on the approach to the church itself. This test pit 54, we wanted to test just how far south are we still getting medieval pottery along the old road. And we got 1 sherd out of 54 and the same with 52. So it's very clear that the medieval activity is centered more around here, but we are still getting a little bit as you go along Dog Kennel Lane. And then north of the river, we put in a few more pits These two are just either side, again, of the old road, and we are getting lots of medieval and lots of Roman out of them. I'm just going to sort of finish there on Test Pit 72, where, again, we are getting Roman out at the very bottom, including some nice chunky pieces, sort of combed box flute tile, and the only Roman coin we ended up getting from the test pitting. So we've got the sort of late 3rd century radiate that was found. This kind of is very nice for the people who spend ages sieving the material, and when they're able to sort of pull something out. That's a quick overview of the test pits. What does this mean, though? What is the point of digging 73 test pits if we can't start to analyze and say, what can we say about the material? Well, this, firstly, pottery is probably the most important thing that we assess when we do the test pitting. We find a lot of iron nails. We find a lot of, glass, anything from sort of 17th century to modern, a lot of building material. But pottery is the main thing that's going to date all of our features. At the moment, we have, and I probably did know the count off the top of my head, and now I'm going to get it wrong. We did have probably at least sort of 1,600, if not close to 2,000 sherds of pottery now. As you can see, the vast majority are sort of 17th, 18th century, which makes perfect sense given we know that that main period of the village that we know of anyway dates to that time. Quite a lot of Victorian, sort of 19th century. But if you actually, I've broken down the medieval. So again, we're talking 400 Saxon all the way up into sort of 15th century before we get to the Tudor. If you were to add all the medieval up, it comes close to being the same amount as the sort of 17th, 18th century. And you can see we're starting to get a decent amount of Roman coming out of there as well. So all of this pottery gets assessed and, as I say, dated, given sort of specific fabrics. Our most common type of pottery, so not quite a quarter, but at least 20% of all of it, is what we call post-medieval redware. Now, post-medieval redware is very, very broad. It sort of dates from anywhere from sort of 1580 all the way up into sort of 1800s. These are sort of late 16th century redware that you would find in London. These examples actually are from the Historic Jamestown website, so it does make its way, quite further afield as well. But it also is such a broad period that it can include Victorian flower pots. So, it's very broad, and a lot of this is probably just as easily that time frame versus that one. 17% is what we call refined whiteware, so white earthenware. So again, it's going to be some of your china and porcelain sort of plates, again, related to our sort of 19th century activity. And the third highest type is this what we call sort of our Q2. This is a sandy ware, a medieval sandy ware that is sort of dates from 1150 to 1250. And they're your cooking pots and your cooking vessels. So we do have a lot of medieval pottery as well. And that tends to be our most common type. But there are several other fabrics as well, which as I said, I didn't really put into this because it was a lot more detailed than what we needed. But what we also do with 73 test pits is we start to plot where all that pottery actually appears. And the whole point of this is you try to find patterns. Where can we see differences? Now, I have to apologize. My color choice was really poor, especially in this lighting. We only have about 5 sherds there of prehistoric pottery. And there's one down there as well. That's just to show you that our only prehistoric, sort of here and there, which again is a bit telling because it's along the old road and focuses in this area. Now, if you put our only Roman pottery in, again, entirely clustered in this field, so all these sort of red dots, and then we add our medieval. So one thing that is quite interesting is just how much medieval there is in this area of the paddock, north of the river, obviously around the old junction of the old roads, and not very much here by the church or the mansion. Now, some of this is also down to the fact that we haven't been able to dig as many test pits in this area as perhaps we would have liked to. A, because we can't get into the gardens of the actual house, and we're not digging in the churchyard, and also all of those services I showed you before, the drives, it's very busy around the church anyway. However, that is a very clear pattern here. as I say, including that area, which I'll talk about again shortly, where perhaps we have another river crossing back towards the church. But when you compare the medieval to the post-medieval, hopefully you can see what a major shift we get by the Tudor period, where we're starting to match up with that map that we know of, again, as early as 1701, of what our sort of post-medieval village is looking like. So again, this area here where we had our cottage, there's no medieval activity on these sort of slopes that are again sort of northward facing, going down towards the river. Nothing in this area here. We still have the medieval focus here, but again, much more prominently making use of these sort of north-facing slopes in the post-medieval period, whereas with the exception of Grange Cottage, Cook's Place, which we know sort of here, clearly we're not sort of occupying, again, these are fields at that point, and we're not having as much occupation. And then I just sort of throw in the 19th century, which again very much reflects where the keeper's cottage, the outbuildings that we know of by that time that are showing up on the tithe map, the OS map, during that time. So the patterns, I would say, very much fit what we expect, except for that medieval, which again is showing such an interesting concentration in that area. Now, we can also map other finds as well. So this is mapping our, what we call CBM. That's our abbreviation for ceramic building material. So that is tile, and that is brick, and this is by weight. Now, I would say most of that weight is being taken up by our bricks, more so than our tiles. And again, not surprisingly, our biggest concentrations are where those cottages are. So I'm just gonna plot that there over our estate map. You know, kind of what we would expect then, still having those concentrations there along the road junction, but it's where we expect our very large cottages that are being demolished, again, around 1800. But what you can also do is plot where our Roman building material comes from. And now when I say Roman building material, I'm talking, it might just be a tiny little fragment of a combed, you know, box flue tile or a tesserae, or imbrex, you know, one of the roof tiles. If you have a dot here, it probably is literally one piece, whereas there are a few more that are showing up here. But the main takeaway is that the Roman, if you do have it south of the river, is again only along the old road, which we're going to be talking about again in a minute. Now, originally, this project was meant to be trying to find the deserted medieval village, the former medieval settlement. We did not expect to find Roman. Quite pleased that we found Roman, and we'll talk about, you know, again, what more we can say about that. The Roman finds are all, so the green are, I'm going to talk about this in a second, detecting finds that are Roman. The red is the CBM, and that's the pottery. But you can see we clearly, if you plot all of our Roman finds, such a big concentration in this area. Our detecting finds are also mainly showing up where we have these sort of post-medieval banks. Reason being, because again, so they're showing up along these, is because again, these are features that have a lot of upcasts and the material's being churned up. So the detectorists can only actually find the material, you know, often maybe 20 centimeters, you know, below the surface, so it's quite shallow, whereas we know the Roman would be deeper. So that's along one of those banks. I should add, even though I'm sure this audience is entirely trustworthy, that the detectorists, by the way, you know, there is no detecting allowed on the estate normally. This is special permission as part of the archaeological project, and everything that they are recording goes on the Portable Antiquities Scheme online. So this is just a screenshot of all of the detecting finds of any period that are on the website at the moment. And I would say that before last year, this was blank. So again, it's only, you know, we've managed to get these up. This is a researcher's view. The public view would not show this level of detail, but all the finds would be on there if you want to see them. And I'll say at the end tonight, Andrew and Chris, who are 2/3 of our detecting team and found all of these, will very happily show you and talk to you about any of them. But really interesting and sort of very worthwhile of why we do this detecting, because we can get very clear distributions of, you know, where is the Roman coming from, where are the medieval finds coming from. To date, we have, I'm going to say 15, it's between 15 and 20 Roman coins have now come out from the detecting. That is just sort of one of them. We've got a very nice sort of a Vulvate mount, again, sort of late 2nd or 3rd century Roman, and probably our nicest Roman find. So nice, again, you even have the pin, you know, surviving, that's in the back as well, is a 2nd century brooch. The geology of the park is brilliant for preservation of these items. So again, on different landscapes, these would be much more corroded. They wouldn't have survived anywhere near to that extent. Unfortunately, especially because Andrew found some of our nicest medieval items, I didn't actually put pictures up of them, but there are some lovely ones that came out as well. But I just wanted to focus on the Roman. So again, all of these coming up in these areas here of those sort of banks. What does this say about Albury and the park and sort of the wider Roman landscape? So this is a plot, I didn't put a legend up, it would have been too complicated to explain, but this is all of the Roman archaeology that we know of being plotted for the region. We've got our villa that we know of at Abinger, obviously temple at Farley Heath, a couple pottery kilns in that area as well. Again, this would have been blank before now, but this is our site at Albury. And then, of course, you've got a very big cluster up at West Clandon, where, again, detecting finds have suggested that surely there's a Roman road running through there, because you don't get that much Roman spread over an area if it's not sort of a roadside settlement. Why this is interesting, though, is that the only Roman, if you ignore those reds, by the way, again, the only Roman finds anywhere near the park before the project was this very, well, actually it's a chunky bit of combed box flue tile that's being found here, sort of that's just to, that's around Silent Pool. And then you've got, I think it's just a little coin here, just at the southwest corner of the park. It is not a coincidence they're along the old road, I'm sure. And the fact that our old road, Old Dog Kennel Lane, you can even make out here so clearly on the LiDAR, I'm fairly confident between the prehistoric, between the Roman, that it is a prehistoric trackway. You know, it is a Roman trackway that obviously stays in use over the centuries. And again, this is what we plot these finds specifically to be finding that. So Albury is in the right location to be possibly on sort of an east-west route. You know, we know that the route would have, you know, you would have had a road somewhere here along the Tillingbourne that would have connected Abinger, for instance, to Dorking, which is the next sort of major Roman settlement. Whether or not the Roman road would have gone sort of Newlands Corner, whether it would have cut and done more of the North Downs, we don't know. This is the difficulty of trying to plot Roman roads. But we clearly have a settlement here of some significance that needs a bit wider investigation. And if we just sort of look again at this building, it is very clearly, in my opinion, a villa, or very villa-like. It is a masonry building. You wouldn't be having something, you know, along those sort of lines. And I just sort of bring up this very nice parallel of Gorhambury, which is near St. Albans, which even similarly has that little sort of projecting porch there. You can see in that sort of the winged, the corridor house, and as I say, possibly some sort of building here. This also has later medieval elements as well at Gorhambury, so there are some nice parallels. We don't know that it's certainly a Roman site and Roman buildings until we put bigger trenches across them. As I say, test pits are not good for something that small, but it is exciting, and I think it certainly, you know, warrants more investigation. There are limits with this project. There are limits with test pitting. I'm just sort of showing you again the plot of our medieval pot versus our post-medieval pot, in that, you know, there are always going to be areas where you would like to put a test pit and you can't dig. You know, it would be very interesting to know where the road crossing is. We're not going to get much more evidence than here. We're not going to be able to put test pits in here. We're never really going to be able to get test pits anywhere around, you know, where the current crossing is, again, because of all the services. If we put in a couple more, we would probably try to get them around this area. So again, you know, just before it starts to get too wet and before you get into the real landscape part of the garden, just to see, does this medieval activity, for instance, continue to occur north of the church, or is the focus of medieval village here, and then they cross over, and again, just a little bit of focus, you know, around the church and the house. It is not unusual in a medieval settlement for the church and the manor house to be separate from the main village. So, as I say, but we do, it is also how old, how ancient is this road that continued along to Shear? If it is as old, of course, as the original settlement, we can still expect some more medieval possibly to be continuing that way. It's difficult to say. Negative evidence, so the lack of having, you know, medieval pottery somewhere doesn't mean it doesn't exist, it just means we can't dig it. And as I say, we obviously have some areas where we still currently have houses or occupation where we're not going to be able to put in test pits. But there is a reason for having all of these. As I say, it really does start to show you some interesting patterns anyway. We know for sites like our Roman area, though, where you start to need obviously larger areas probably being opened to get a better sense of this. And I just kind of want to finally, you know, close and add about just how important the volunteers really have been on all of this. We haven't quite had 100, but over the course of 3 years, we've had at least 90 different people who have come and helped do the test pitting and geophysics. A couple of them maybe only did it for a day. And I think we've had some of them literally for, you know, all 3 weeks over three seasons, being there pretty much every day. We managed to get, I think, 3 different schools last year. One of our young archaeologists club, in this case, Chertsey Museum, come this year, work placement students. Test pitting is so great, as I say, because, you know, anyone can get in, from families, I say, to much older, and hours and countless hours, again, of all the volunteers who are actually taking the time under the microscope to analyze and assess all of the pottery. So I'm just going to end there thanking a few people, and I'm sure, because I'm doing this off the top of my head, I'm going to forget people. Michael Baxter, we really do have to thank, firstly, in the Albury State for even letting us do this. I know how, you know, disruptive and annoying it can occasionally be with all the cars and all the people sort of going through the estate. I remember the one time I accidentally, you know, dropped biscuits and fed the squirrels the next day, and, you know, we're always worried about things we might leave behind, you know, for some of the livestock who shouldn't be getting into it, you know, who will. I have to really thank Andrew again for, you know, introducing me probably to Albury and sort of getting me very excited in the project. Andrew and Chris, and I say Mari, who's not here, who actually did the detecting, and there's probably too many of the volunteers to name who, as I say, who are the ones who have actually done the main legwork. I'll finally just add, do have a look at some of the detecting finds. They are online on the Portable Antiquities Scheme. You just have to kind of put in for Albury and sort of focus in on the parish and then run down the list. But it's normally pretty obvious if they've come from our project, because they'll even say that. They'll say they're from ALB-P, which is Albury Park. That's our site code. And there are 2 copies of Surrey's Past, which is a society's magazine, in the back. They're my copy, so please don't take them away. But it's just to say that they are online as well. So if you want to read about the 2023 dig or the 2024 dig, they are both write-ups now in them. And if you just go to Surrey's, the Society's website, and could look at the back issues of Surrey's Past, you can read them. But otherwise, yeah, thank you, and happy to answer any questions.
Can't follow that, can you? And so, very grateful to you for doing this, because actually, for people's knowledge of history around it, this adds a much more depth to what was been sort of known before. History seems to have gone back sort of 300 years, 400 years here. Now we see there's a dimension that goes much further back. And as I mentioned to you, it sort of fills a little hole in the map, doesn't it, very nicely from
yes.
Brandon to Dorking and so on. It's a, logically something had to be around here.
Yeah.
And you're lucky, it looks like you may have it here.
Well, and I have to say, when we, you know, David Bird has got, who again, many of you probably know, sort of our lead expert on Roman Surrey. He's very excited anyway. He said he always knew something should be in Albury. Yes, yeah, a villa. It's a perfect location for it. We don't like to throw out the word villa. We'll call it a very minor, small
in
villa,
a way, Finch did everybody a favour because it stopped any later development.
Exactly. And it's a, as I say, I've never worked on a landscape that, as I say, it's just so untouched in some ways. As I say, normally it's been ploughed over. But the fact that you can still just walk over, you can very clearly see, you know, as I say, those bumps in the landscape.
It
that,
hasn't
that's
been
quite
terrible, has it? It's just been livestock.
Which...
I'm going to ask you to do it again. And Michael, thank you for allowing me to persuade you. Said he. Yes.
Happy to answer any questions. Yes, thank you.
Right. This is a Christmas fair, by the way.
Okay.
So what's next?
No, I don't think so. So, again, I'm probably sort of slightly putting Michael on the spot here. We've discussed that we might go back again next year and do something. I think there will still be a little bit more test pitting. There are areas where we don't want to bother with. It's very clear we've covered most of Brewhouse Meadow. As I say, there are one or two places by the church. It is getting more interesting where we might put a couple pits in. But at this point, we want more bigger trenches, sort of 1 meter slots across the Roman area. So hopefully we can think about maybe going back in September. I should add that area of the paddock where the Roman is, it's only available in September as well because the cattle are there most of the rest of the year. So that's sort of the one guaranteed time that we can sort of get in there. So fingers crossed, we will look at another sort of community dig. And again, keep your eyes peeled. It is open to anyone, so yes.
So normally, a bigger archaeologist, do you go from the pit to trenches?
Yes. Well, the trenches would be probably the main. I mean, the as far as we would go at that point, it's sort of a matter of how big do you do it. Those of you who know the Society's dig at Abinger, you know, at the villa there that's been ongoing for ages, it's all dependent on the director. So some people like massive trenches, you know, sort of 20 by 20 meter. I prefer small trenches, what we call sort of trial trenches or slots where you expose smaller areas, but over, you know, again, maybe several locations, so maybe four or five of them. One thing that we've learned over the years with archaeology is you never want to completely strip a site. You know, we tend to now go back and dig sites that were dug 70 years ago or 100 years ago, and if they had completely dug them then, we wouldn't have anything to dig now. So if you've got a building, you know, you just need to maybe, you know, put a trench across and get an idea of the profile of the building. You don't have to dig the whole thing. So plus nowadays, you know, with museums filling up, we have to be very careful that we're not acquiring so much material that we can't sort of deal with it. So I would sort of opt for small scale to start with and then see how we go. The downside of that area of the paddock, again, those of you who know it, it's very publicly visible. I think people will be walking by like, oh, I wonder what's going on. And, you know, you can be seen there very clearly. So we always have to be a bit careful and wary of too much, you know, public notice, or at least just sort of protecting it and making sure no one comes in. And that's part of the reason the detectorists are currently going over the site, because we don't want anyone to get wind of, you know, and then want to legally detect it. Yes, we don't have one, but we would potentially look into hiring one. That could be very, very useful. Yes. At the moment, the archaeology is quite shallow, so the resistivity seems pretty useful at showing what would be there. But yes, if we got to a point where we could borrow or hire for cheap a GPR, it might give us a little bit more information. Because what it's very good at doing is it does time depth, so it actually tells you what's on top of what, whereas with resistivity, it just shows you, you know, again, sort of a, you know, what's there, and you can't tell, you know, the age of it. Yeah.
Would you need much more detail to produce sort of plans of how the layout might have been at various stages of history?
Of the park generally?
Yeah.
I mean, I'll be honest, those maps I showed you are about the best it's probably, you know, going to get. Because you can only do it based on, as I say, the finds you have. You know, there are difficulties even with that. So we have to remember that what I plotted there is any medieval pottery, even if that medieval pottery is showing up in topsoil, whereas we could also do a separate map that just shows where the actual medieval levels are, which gives a little bit more insight, because obviously things can move around, you know, especially in landscaping. But that is probably the best we're going to be able to do at the moment, is say just show where we have clear concentration anyway of medieval versus not. I should say, sorry, I didn't bother including them. We can break up, you know, the pottery even more. So I did say, you know, so that's, you know, our 11th and 12th versus our 13th, 15th versus our 16th, 17th, you know, so you can be more specific. I lumped it a bit just for the purpose of the presentation. But yes, we can make a few more patterns.
Yeah, I think you said in one place you found a medieval book clasp.
Mm.
Which was about this far above the surface.
Yes.
And there was something else in the medieval.
A buckle, yes. Yes.
It seemed to be an enormous difference. Why was something so close to the surface if the land had never been ploughed? I think they're supposed to be down.
And I would say that particular one, again, we're at that area where we've got probably these post-medieval banks as well. So I think you're having a lot of upcasts.
Right.
As I say, the fact that all that, I'll put back on again in a second here, all of those, I mean, in a normal situation, you wouldn't probably be getting so much of that Roman, you know, all of the good detecting finds, you know, as I say, they're very clearly along those banks as well. I think they would have been deeper otherwise, likely. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah. Pardon? So the society, so Surrey Ecological Society, at the moment they're entirely funding this. To be fair, there's not a lot of cost involved. So beyond my time as a member of staff anyway, we haven't yet really had to pay for anything. Our GPS costs £10 an hour, you know, and an annual sub. All the finds currently are being looked at in-house. If we do a bigger dig, then we have to look at some more budget for things like carbon dates. And again, if we find some finds that we need proper specialist assessment. But yes, at the moment, it probably would come from our research budget anyway. Any other questions? Okay.
Again, thank you.
Thank you.
Time for people to chat. It's our final one for the year. And hopefully next year we will have a full programme again. But I'm trying to persuade certain people that we should certainly set up the programme and relying on persuasion that we have a hall to hold all of them in.
Yes.
So watch this space from Aubrey History Society.